love the idea that we're just continuing to worship. I like the way Bryce said that. Because, man, I don't know about you, but it was one of those moments just a minute ago where I just didn't want that moment to stop. I had to remind myself that worship is not just singing. It is also giving. And it's also speaking the word. And so let's continue to worship together. Sound good? Well, we don't have a choice. Okay. Last week, we began a sub-series in our overall series of the year with Jesus. Last week, we began a sub-series that we're actually going to be talking about the next 5 weeks or so. And the series is warnings. Warnings. Jesus warns us against certain things. There are certain things that Jesus rings the alarm and says, you have to pay attention to this. Because if you don't, it will devour you. It will devour your community. It will destroy your witness to the world. Warnings. And last week we talked about hypocrisy, about living life behind a mask. And one of the things I love about these warnings is that Jesus doesn't just give us a caution. He gives us the weapons to actually deal with that which he is warning us about. And so last week we talked about community and confession are the weapons with which we use to fight hypocrisy. And so, in light of last week's sermon in front of my community, I thought it only appropriate that I start by making a confession. I hate the life of John. The apostle, the disciple, one of the inner three. My confession this morning is I hate the life of John. I absolutely hate the life of John. And no, it's not because I'm jealous of his incredible conversion, although that's a pretty cool story. You remember that one? That's not rhetorical. Do you remember that story? No. Luke chapter 5, turn there with me. If we can't remember it, we got to review it. Luke chapter 5. Jesus is on the Lake of Gennesaret. And all of the crowds are coming to hear Jesus because his ministry is really exploding. He's on the Lake of Gennesaret, but his problem is that all the crowds are packing in so much on the shore that if he starts to speak, all of them won't be able to hear him. So Jesus looks over and he notices two boats that were docked on the shore. They're fishing boats. And they'd been out all night long fishing, trying to catch fish, and they're now cleaning their nets. And so Jesus walks over to one of them, and it happens to belong to a guy named Simon Peter. And Jesus says, hey, do you mind if I borrow your boat for a bit? I mean, not to fish, but we could just put it out into water a little bit so I can speak to the crowds. See, because Jesus knew that if he spoke to them on a boat, the water actually functions as kind of an ancient amplification system. So the entire crowd would be able to hear him as he teaches them the word. And in verse 4, something really kind of frustrates me about this text. Luke chapter 5, verse 4 begins, when he had finished speaking. I'm like, what? Like, the first three verses, we've been building to this moment where Jesus goes over and he gets a boat and he moves out so he can start teaching to the crowd, and we don't even get to hear what he says. Not a word. It's just when he had finished speaking, I'm like, well, man, I hope that wasn't important because we don't even know what he says. As a matter of fact, the only words we get in the first 9 verses that are read, therefore spoken by Jesus, is in verse 4. Jesus looks at Simon Peter and he says, put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch. Now, on the surface, that's a rather benign request. It's just kind of like, oh, okay, he just wants to go and, you know, play around in the water. But if you look at it a little closer, that's a pretty ridiculous thing for Jesus to say. It's even somewhat offensive because Jesus is a peasant carpenter. Therefore, he has the occupational authority to talk about the wooden structure of the boat. He has the occupational authority to talk about the wooden structure of the oars they use to row the boat. The occupational authority to even talk about the driftwood that's going by the boat. But he doesn't have the occupational authority to tell a professional fisherman how to fish. But he says, hey, why don't we go put out into deep water and let down our nets for a catch? My goodness, any fisherman in the ancient world worth their salt even knew, you don't go fishing in the morning time. You fish at night, hence why the boats were on shore from a night full of fishing that was unproductive. But this peasant carpenter tells this professional fisherman how to fish. And Peter, oh man, you can even hear it in verse 5 in his voice. He's kind of like, okay, Lord, you know, we were out all night, didn't catch a fish at all, but because you're Jesus and all, I guess I'll do what you say. And so Peter humors Jesus, puts out into the deep water, lets down his nets, and what happens? Yeah, absolutely. What did it say? Yell it out again, brother. I'm glad you're here. He catches a bunch of fish, doesn't he? So many stinking fish that the nets start to break. And if that wasn't a big enough problem, he calls over the other boat. Remember this part? He calls over the second boat, and they have another problem because they fill their boats so full of fish, both boats start to sink. Both boats start to sink. And Peter, in that moment, understands who Jesus is because of what he just did. Peter falls down and he says, leave me, Lord. I am not even worthy to have you in my presence. Leave me. And the same effect was found on the other people that were present. Verse 9 says, for Peter and all of his companions were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. Then Jesus said to Peter, don't be afraid. From now on, you will not catch fish. You'll catch men. And then something weird happens in verse 11. So they pulled their boats up on shore, left everything, and followed him. You know, there's some of those verses that at times you can read them in a way where you almost skip over it. And you miss the impact of the verse. Where you just kind of flippantly go past it, and you don't realize the astonishing thing that you just read. And verse 11 is one of those verses. Something weird happens here. For the text says they left everything and followed Jesus. These fishermen had just caught the greatest catch probably in their entire lives, maybe in the history of all of fishing. And they leave it in the boats? They leave the gold mine, their big payday, in the boats. Why? To follow Jesus. My goodness. Now that is a conversion story. That's incredible. But I hate the life of John. I hate the life of John. And no, it's not because I'm jealous of the incredible conversion, although like we have heard, it's pretty cool. And it's not because I'm jealous that he got to see a bunch of really amazing things when he hung out with Jesus for 3 years. Like Luke chapter 9 is bursting at the seams with amazing event after amazing event that John witnessed. Luke chapter 9 begins with Jesus sending the 12 disciples out on their own mission. He sends them out to preach the word and to heal those that are sick. And John and the other apostles, they were sent out and they preached and they healed. Amazing. But the story gets better in chapter 9. Chapter 9, verse 10, John gets to witness Jesus feeding over 5,000 people with only 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now, I would have loved to have been there to see that. You know what I mean? It's like unbelievable. The more we give out, the more we have. The more we give out, the more we have. Even to the point where we have 12 basketfuls left over. That's a cool trick. But it just gets better. Because once you go down in Luke chapter 9, verse 18, Jesus actually allows Peter to identify who he is. And John witnesses, for the first time ever uttered in the history of the world, the great confession. The confession that we even heard this morning in baptism, the great confession. For John was there whenever Peter said, but you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus says, this wasn't revealed to you by men, but this revealed to you by God himself. And John was there. But chapter 9 just gets better. Because then in verse 28, all of a sudden, Jesus says, hey, Peter, James, and John, I want you guys to come up on the mountain with me just to pray. And they're like, okay, Jesus. I mean, we are the best three anyway. So let's head on up. They go up there and they realize all of a sudden they're not alone. Because Jesus is over there talking with some people that they recognize in their mind's eye from all the stories that they heard when they were the kids. That they saw Elijah and Moses talking with Jesus. And then a cloud comes down and envelops them, and a voice from heaven says, shut up, Peter, listen to Jesus. And then the next thing you know, Jesus is a human light bright. It's an unbelievable scene that John gets to experience. But I hate the life of John. No, it's not because I'm jealous of his conversion. It's not because I'm jealous of the amazing things he saw, although I would have loved to have been there for pretty much any of those scenes. I hate the life of John because, man, was he arrogant. My goodness, was he arrogant. I mean, his arrogance pretty much knew no limits. Whenever you're in the chapter 9 of Luke and you see all these amazing things, it is astonishing what you see John say in verse 51 of chapter 9. I mean, after he sees what God can do whenever he empowers him for his mission, he goes out and preaches and heals. Whenever he sees the power of God in the feeding of the 5,000, whenever he sees the power of God to illuminate who he is in the great confession, and when he sees the power of God in the transfiguration, it doesn't shake him of saying one of the most arrogant things I have ever read. Because Luke chapter 9, verses 51 through 54 says this. As the time approached for Jesus to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for Jesus. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When the disciples, James and John, saw this, they asked, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven and destroy them all? Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven and just wipe out these pesky Samaritans because they're not one of us? And anybody outside of us, frankly, I don't really care about. They can burn for all I care. John's arrogance is on full display. For his request basically says this. If you're not on the inside, you're on the outside. Who really cares about you then? You see, the Jews and the Samaritans had a little bit of a rough history. The Jews hated the Samaritans. Hated the Samaritans. The Samaritans, in the eyes of the Jews, were half-breeds. Because during the Babylonian exile, these full-blooded Jews began to intermarry and to pervert the pure bloodline of God. And so when the exile ends and the Samaritans come to help rebuild the temple, they say, brothers, well, let us give you a hand to rebuild the temple, to celebrate our God. And the response was, you're not my brother. You're a bunch of half-breeds. You are impure. You're despicable. You are worse than even full-blooded Gentiles. You are lower than the dogs. Get away from us because you're making everyone and everything unclean. The Jews hated the Samaritans so much that if you're a Jew and you lived in northern Galilee and you wanted to go to Jerusalem in the south to celebrate the festivals, you would not go the most direct path straight through Samaria. Instead, what you would do is you would go dozens of miles out of your way by crossing the Jordan River, bypassing Samaria, then coming back so that you could get to Jerusalem, because you wouldn't want to step foot in the dirty region, the dirty cities of those stinking Samaritans. Now, I'm not up here saying that the Samaritans were innocent in this animosity. But what I am saying is this. John's arrogance is on full display. If you're not on the inside, you're on the outside, you can burn for all we care. You see, I hate the life of John because he is so arrogant. And not just towards the people on the outside of the community, but even towards the people on the inside of his community, his brothers and sisters. Even the other disciples were targets for John. If you look in Luke chapter 9, verse 46, there's an interesting discussion going on amongst the disciples. Who is the greatest in the kingdom? It's a discussion that reminds me of Mark chapter 10, verse 35. Go ahead and flip there. Mark chapter 10, verse 35, has James and John, the sons of thunder, the sons of Zebedee, on full display. Verse 35 of chapter 10 in Mark, it says, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus. And I imagine them whispering here. Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. That's bold. And Jesus says, okay, what do you want me to do for you? Well, you know, just let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left when you come in your glory. Jesus says, you don't know what you're asking for. Oh, but Jesus, they did know what they were asking for. They were asking for the positions of power. They were asking for the positions of prominence. They were asking for the positions of prestige, the chief seats in the kingdom, not only above all of Israel, but even above the other 10 disciples. And that's why it shouldn't surprise us in verse 41 when it says, when the other 10 disciples heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. I mean, can you blame them? Can you blame them for being a little upset? I mean, honestly, am I the only one that thinks that's a logical way of reacting? Basically, what James and John did here was they backstabbed brothers in their community in order to get what they wanted. They were willing to sacrifice them, to even undercut them, to undermine them, do whatever it took to sit in the chief seats. I'm sorry, but I hate the life of John. I hate the life of John because the arrogance of this apostle seems to know no limits. I hate the life of John because he's not only arrogant towards those on the inside, but those on the outside. I hate talking about it. I hate studying it. I hate the life of John because it's full of moments of malice. It's full of moments of hatred. It's full of schemes of deceit. It is full of moments of backstabbing or condemning those on the inside or the out. I hate the life of John because I feel like I'm looking at a mirror into my own soul. I hate the life of John because when I look at his life, I see a reflection of my own life. And I don't like what I see. I look at his arrogance towards those on the outside and towards those on the inside, and I see myself. I hate studying it because it's hard to stare into that reflection and know what I'm doing with the grace, the gift that God has given me. And I realize that John's worst moments are better than my greatest moments. Some of you may be thinking, oh, that's one of those preacher overstatements. No, it's not. It really is, and I understand, but it's not. Because whether we're looking at him the way he treated people on the outside or whether he's treating the people on the inside, I see that in myself. And at least John left everything to follow Jesus. I can't even claim that. I hate the life of John. Because I don't like what I see when I see the mirror reflecting back at me in his own life. I mean, whether we're talking about people on the outside or the inside, I see the same thing in me. For example, whether we like it or not, in America and in Joplin, there is an increasing number of people that are homosexuals. Whether we like it or not. And I can stand up here today and say, oh, I pray for them and I love them. But my actions betray my true heart. I mean, the closest that I usually get to anybody that is homosexual is usually when I'm in a voting booth voting against them or boycotting some establishment that I heard donated to them. Let's be honest. As a church, we have failed them. We have absolutely abandoned them. I see the way we treat the homosexual community the same way that John treated the Samaritan people. Even though we may not say it, our actions say that we would rather just have fire come down and take them out. Now listen, I affirm the scriptures that say that that is a lifestyle of sin. But I also affirm the scriptures that say that I too am a sinner that is in need of grace. I don't need more condemnation heaped on me. I need people to love me into moments of transformation. We have failed them. For we spend most of our time, money, and energy protesting them and telling them that we disagree with them, and we've not spent the same amount of time, money, and energy loving them in the name of Jesus. For we run at them with closed fists when we should show them the open hands of Christ with scars on them. For we too are sinners. And even whenever I was an enemy, God made a way for me through Jesus. We have got to make this right. Because the way that we love people outside of our community will directly impact the way we love people inside our community. You see, I hate the life of John. Because it's like a mirror into my own soul, and I do not like what I see. It's not just those on the outside, though. It's also those on the inside that my arrogance seems to know no limits. The elders, I was at one of the meetings a couple weeks ago, and they asked me, they said, just tell us some of your story. I was like, well, man, you know, honestly, I was born in a pew. Like, I mean, I've been in the church all my life. Like, I don't have one of these major, you know, like, I went away and was, you know, whatever. And it's not that those are bad. It's just that's not my story. It's not that I've never done bad things. It's just I had good parents. I'm not ashamed of that. I'm very thankful. I was born in a pew. I've grown up all my life in the church. And yet, I noticed at about 10 years ago that even though I'd grown up all my life in the church, listening to stories about the Prince of Peace, I walked around with such a chip on my shoulder. Unbelievable. My arrogance towards those that were inside the community was palpable. Especially when we started talking about one particular issue, worship music. Oh man, I thought I had it all figured out. My attitude, my heart, my arrogance kind of sounded something like this. Oh, if you just old fogies would get out of the way, we could grow this church. Oh man, we've got it all figured out. If everybody would just dress like me and listen to the music I like, then actually the gospel would advance. The problem is, we don't need more organs, we need more energy. We don't need more youth, we need more people that look just like me. Why? Because we have the chief seats now. And then about 10 years ago, I had a conversation, and even though the conversation wasn't intended to rebuke me, it did. I was at a church that was going through this shift into contemporary music, which is always brutally painful. I don't know what was going through my mind, but I was standing next to this older gentleman, and I said, what do you think about the music? And he responded exactly like I thought he would. Kind of. He's like, oh, I hate it. I hate the music. I mean, it's so loud and clangy, the drums, and most of the songs, I don't even know the lyrics. I just can't stand it. And I remember sitting there thinking, okay, old man, just get with it or get out, because we have the chief seats now. Deal with it. And then he said something that shocked me. He said, but I wouldn't change it for anything. I said, well, what? Like, why not? I mean, everybody wants the chief seats. Why wouldn't you fight back? I mean, why in the world? What do you mean you wouldn't change it? You obviously have a problem with it. Why aren't you fighting the way we are? He said, son, what you need to understand is what I've learned. The kingdom's just bigger than me. And I realized in that moment that the problem wasn't the older generation. The problem was the arrogance in my own heart. To want to fight even the people inside of my community just so that I can sit on the chief seats. I realized that I'm acting like a fool and completely opposite of the gospel of Jesus Christ when I'm forcing people to want to do it my way. What this man taught me was that the younger generation cannot sacrifice the elder generation on the altar of progressive worship any more than any other issues that will come up that Satan can use to divide the body. The younger generation shouldn't look at the older generation as obstacles, but as opportunities to learn wisdom. You can only learn whenever you live longer than I have. The older generation, at the same time, should not look at the younger generations as people that are stealing something from them, but opportunities for you to minister to people that desperately need your wisdom. God has made the body of Christ, both old and young, together, not so that wars would create, but so that we would stop being foolish, fighting over things that don't matter. I pray that we move into an irreversible season, not just in our church, but in America as a whole. That we are so focused on the mission of seeking and saving the lost that we don't have time to fight about worship styles. We don't have time to fight about things that don't matter. Man, I oftentimes wonder if the persecuted underground church of China has the same arguments we do. Don't think they do, because they are so focused on the mission that they cannot use things that don't matter to separate us. You see, I hate the life of John because it's like it's a mirror staring at me, and I see into my own soul and I don't like what I see. I don't like the arrogance that I see in my own heart towards those outside. I don't like my arrogance that I see in my own heart against those on the inside. But I love the life of John because he gives me hope for transformation. You see, the amazing thing about John is something drastic happens between Luke 9 and Revelation chapter 1. Something that is so dramatic, something that is so overwhelming, that it turns this arrogant, fire-wielding bigot into a person that writes a gospel and never mentions his own name. Read the Gospel of John, and you will not see his name appear, because something happened between Luke 9 and Revelation 1. Oh, in Revelation 1, he does mention his name. Revelation chapter 1, verse 9 says, I, John, your brother and your companion in the suffering and in the kingdom and in the patient endurance that are ours in Jesus Christ. Not exactly a way I would expect an arrogant person to identify themselves. Why? Because something's happened between Luke 9 and Revelation 1. It's called a cross in an empty tomb. You see, when Jesus was crucified on the cross, so too was your pride. When Jesus was nailed to a tree, so too was your arrogance. When Jesus resurrected, he resurrected into a life of humility, and John got it. But will we? You see, in Mark chapter 10, 35 through 45, whenever John is asking for a chief seat in the kingdom, the last verse of that text, in verse 45, Jesus says this, for the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his own life as a ransom for many. Now, if the Lord of the universe, the creator of all of creation, if the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords does not come down here and demand to be served, but to serve, how much more should we? And John got it. But will we? You see, I hate the life of John, because it's like a mirror into my own soul. I don't like what I see. But I love the life of John because he gives me hope that God can transform someone even like me. through the power of the cross and the power of the resurrection, he can make me new too. John got it, but will we, College Heights Christian Church? The first step, though, is just admitting we have a problem.